A yacht navigating the calm waters of the Mediterranean.
I'm in the Mediterranean, on the trail of a legend. A warrior from Greece who triumphed at Troy. His name is Odysseus, and he's the hero of a 2,500-year-old poem called The Odyssey.
Simon Armitage is on board the boat.
It's the diary of a lost man and a wandering soul. It describes a 10-year journey crisscrossing these oceans and pinballing between islands.
Told by our first author, Homer, The Odyssey has become a foundation stone of Western literature.
But who is Odysseus? A brave hero, certainly, and a brilliant, resourceful strategist, renowned for his cunning and his guile. But is he also a bit slippery and a bit devious? A bit of a show-off, with medals and lovers to his name. I've come to Greece not just to follow his trail and tell his story, but to try and get inside his mind and to try and work out once and for all whether I really like him.
BBC Gods and Monsters, Homer's Odyssey, with Simon Armitage. Long grass and red poppies flutter in the breeze and waves roll up against the shore.
Sing to me of the man, Muse, the man of twists and turns, driven time and again off course. Once he had plundered the hallowed heights of Troy.
Simon's driving along a coastal road.
In the opening lines of the Odyssey, Homer introduces us to its hero. His name is Odysseus. And my journey begins in the place where he made his name, Troy.
This is northwestern Turkey, and very nice it is too. And this body of water just over my shoulder here, in the Straits of the Dardanelles, a really important waterway through history. Over there is Europe, and this side is Asia, and it's always been described as a kind of cultural fault line dividing the two. Dripping with history and legend. It's a place that I only thought really existed on a map and in books. But it's real, and I'm here.
Hulking cargo ships linger on the horizon between the dark sea and pale blue sky. Wild flowers sprout out from the crumbling walls of an ancient ruin.
Many believe these remains are those of the legendary city of Troy. Today, it's just a pile of old stones. But 3,000 years ago, it would have looked very different.
Computer imagery rebuilds the city brick by brick.
The Troy described by the poet Homer was a powerful city-state. But then the Greeks came here to fight a famous war. For 10 years, they tried to smash through its impregnable walls. And for 10 years, they failed.
It's a bloody and grinding conflict, finally brought to an end, not by brawn, but by brains. And in one of the best known of all myths, the Greeks finally infiltrate the city by hiding inside a wooden horse, apparently left as a gift. It's a moment of tactical genius, dreamed up by someone renowned for their cunning and their guile, and that man is Odysseus.
A replica of the wooden horse.
Odysseus was king of a small island in Greece called Ithaca. And his idea to attack Troy from the inside, using the horse as a hiding place, was the turning point in the war.
Well, I'm inside a horse, which isn't a line that I ever thought I'd end up saying. I probably don't need to explain that it's not the original wooden horse built by the Greek army.
But the fact that, you know, the tourist authorities or whoever will go to the trouble of assembling this is a testament, I think, to the enduring nature of the myth.
Tourists photograph the horse.
According to another myth, Odysseus started the war as a reluctant conscript who didn't even want to come here. But with the Trojan horse, he reinvented himself as a superhero. Yes, it was a brilliant plan, but it's also our first great insight into his personality.
Simon sits by a window on the side of the horse.
There are moments with Odysseus where genius seems to tip over into deviousness and where self-preservation wavers into some kind of self-interest. And it's on those occasions where you start to think of Odysseus as a more complicated and perhaps more questionable character. Questionable his character may be, but after success at Troy, no one cares. It's that very deviousness which has made him invincible, arrogant, and of course, heroic. All he has to do now is get home to Ithaca to become reunited with his wife Penelope and to take his place in the Greek Hall of Fame. The trouble is, it's not going to be that simple.
Simon sits on the steps of an ancient amphitheatre. Waves sweep up the shoreline.
Preparing to leave Troy, Odysseus is about to have the arrogance beaten out of him, piece by piece. Before he can find out who he really is, he must first be broken.
Simon walks onto the sand of a crescent-shaped bay.
The Greeks came here on a mission, and they'd been successful. They defeated the Trojans. It had taken them 10 years, but the hard part was over. It was just a question of getting home now, 300 or 400 miles that way, west. And they would have come down here to this beach to get on the ships. I imagine that the mood would have been one of jubilation and triumph and excitement at the idea of returning back to their homeland. Getting home to Ithaca should only take 10 weeks. But in fact, it takes 10 years, as Odysseus suffers a spectacular fall from grace. For him, it'll be the journey from hell. And I'm going with him.
The sun shimmers on the surface of the sea. Simon's at the helm of a sailing boat.
As I leave Troy, I have my own boat, complete with a skipper, name of George.
Did you ever sail to Ithaca?
Of course, yeah. Many, many times. I know every stone.
I'll be following in Odysseus's wake as he arced around the Mediterranean Sea from Troy to his home island of Ithaca.
I feel like I'm in some huge car. Gear stick. Oops, sorry, wrong way.
Let's go some left.
Okay. You're like my dad on my driving lessons. Yeah. Keep grabbing hold of the wheel.
You're a good captain, but you need more lessons.
I just thought you needed a good hat, and it would all fall into place.
As Odysseus leaves Troy, he's in holiday mood.
That's a good plan. Dual controls.
First stop is a nearby coastal town for a bit of plundering. But he bites off more than he can chew and ends up scarpering with a bloody nose. Straight into another problem, the weather.
They say Britain is a sailing culture because it's an island, but it's nothing like Greece. Greece is all about water and islands and travelling around. And
when you're out here on the water, it's the uncertainty, really. Just the vastness as well. When it's calm, when the sun's shining, it's fine, it's beautiful. The minute that the wind gets up, starts to blow you in any direction, then it feels very threatening.
A swell begins to form.
Odysseus is barely off the jetty when a cataclysmic gale hits.
Simon steers the yacht.
For 9 days, he's sent spinning across the Mediterranean.
George lowers the anchor into the inky black waters.
When his fleet emerges from the chaos, Odysseus drops anchor in a strange and unfamiliar world.
A dramatic natural arch on a stretch of coastline.
The island of the Lotus Eaters is an exotic paradise. But danger lies within.
A field of wild flowers.
The lotus flowers covering the island seem innocent enough. But when eaten, they send the men into a drug-induced stupor. Odysseus keeps his head and hauls the men back to the boats. On this occasion, it's the lower ranks who've messed up. But Odysseus is about to trump them with a mistake of his own.
Back on the yacht, Simon's lying across the deck.
Sailing north overnight, the fleet puts in for supplies at the next island. It's the land of the Cyclops.
Simon makes his way on foot through a forest.
Odysseus is wise enough to know he really should steer clear of this lot.
A gaping cave.
The Cyclops are a breed of lawless, one-eyed giants with no respect for either humans or gods. But Odysseus can't help himself. Especially after he spots some tasty-looking sheep inside a cave. They belong to the Cyclops Polyphemus.
He clambers up into the cave. Moisture drips from the ceiling.
We see three different aspects of Odysseus's character in this incident with Polyphemus the Cyclops. His men want to loot the cave, but Odysseus says, no, let's wait and see if these goods are given to us as gifts out of politeness.
Interesting idea, but also naive. When the Cyclops does return, he eats two of Odysseus's men as an appetizer and puts the rest in his larder for later.
And then we see cunning Odysseus heating up a shaft of olive wood in a fire and jabbing it into Cyclops' eye to blind him so him and his men can escape.
A face-like shape in the cave wall.
We took the fiery-pointed stake and whirled it around in his eye, and the blood flowed round it, all hot as it was. His eyelids above and below and his brows were all singed by the flame from the burning eyeball, and its roots crackled in the fire.
The monstrous face in the rock appears to be in pain.
Finally, we see boastful Odysseus goading Cyclops as he sails away on the boat, shouting, "Tell all men that Odysseus did this to you."
Blurting out his name just to show off is a huge mistake.
Simon leaves the forest.
That's because the Cyclops' father is Poseidon, god of the sea. And annoying a god like him is a very bad idea.
Vast columns bathed in warm sunlight atop a peninsula overlooking the Aegean Sea. Birds scavenge for food on the ruins.
This is the Temple of Poseidon. Overlooking the Aegean Sea, it's as good a place as any to ruminate on Odysseus's unfortunate gaffe.
Life's what you make it. That's what we tend to say these days, but we also talk about good luck and bad luck and chance and coincidence as if there were some indefinable forces at work in the background. In Homer's world, those forces were known as gods, and the whims and the mood of any god could determine not just a man's future, but the destiny of an entire civilization.
Simon stands on the headland and gazes across the calm water at sunset.
Poseidon's not the only god who pokes a trident into Odysseus's affairs. In fact, a lot of the others have a little bit of a soft spot for him. But Poseidon matters more than most. He's the one who now wants Odysseus dead.
Of course, the gods are a great literary device as well. They offer a parallel narrative, and we're privy to their decisions and interventions in a way that Odysseus isn't, and it makes us very powerful as readers, almost godlike. It's a fantastic act of reader flattery on Homer's part.
A motorboat churns up the sea.
Poseidon's vendetta is destined to unravel with violent and bloody consequences. As Odysseus escapes from the Cyclops, the sea god looks on as the fleet is again swept into no man's land. And the men are turned into mincemeat by hordes of cannibal giants.
Simon and George sail beside a rocky coastline.
After the attack, only one ship out of the fleet of 12 survives. They're picked off like fish in a barrel. And devastated and depleted, Odysseus sails on, and he finally arrives at the island of Aea, notable for being an island made up entirely of vowels, but also for its most famous inhabitant, the goddess and sorceress Circe.
Simon wanders along a shingle beach.
Like the aforementioned giants, Circe's also a man-eater. A perfect example of one of the Odyssey's greatest themes. Temptation.
A woman performs a massage on a man's back.
Having turned some of Odysseus's men into pigs, she then lures Odysseus into her bed. A bed he stays in for an entire year.
Simon reads from Homer's Odyssey.
She set me in a bath and bathed me with water from the great cauldron, mixing it to my liking and pouring it over my head and shoulders till she took from my limbs the soul-consuming weariness. But when she had bathed me and anointed me richly with oil and had thrown about me a beautiful cloak and a tunic, she brought me into the hall and made me sit upon a silver-studded chair. A beautiful chair, richly wrought.
Odysseus's behaviour is questionable, to say the least. Has he forgotten his wife, the loyal Penelope, who's been waiting for him back at home? Or is he just recuperating after getting hopelessly lost and watching most of his men die in agony?
It reminds me a little bit of that story about George Best at the height of his notoriety. He's staying in some swanky hotel and the bellboy walks in and finds George there, surrounded by empty champagne bottles and with a former Miss World lying on the bed. And the bellboy says, "George, where did it all go wrong?"
But am I being too quick to judge Odysseus?
A sprawling city of whitewashed buildings.
Leaving him alone with his libido, I've headed back to the Greek mainland and a small harbour near Athens. It's a funny thing, temptation. Is Homer condemning Odysseus for his infidelity with Circe? Or is he just saying, boys will be boys? I thought I'd ask Demetres and Andreas, a couple of retired merchant seamen who spent much of their working lives at sea. What do they think of Odysseus's behaviour? And especially his long affair with Circe.
His big failing was the adoration of women.
I like the fact that you was womanizing. I mean, I can't feel a man, a young man like him, to go away, years and years away from his country, and not womanize. My seaman's life was just the same life. I went to too many places. I've had a lot of experiences. I have met lots of women. I was womanizing for a great part of my life. And then I came to an end. And I think all of us come to an end. I mean, that's the story. It's a very, very human story.
So that makes it very, makes it more real in some sense.
It is real. It is real. That's why this poem is eternal, if you read it and you see the details and so on. You will discover your own life. This is my life.
Yeah.
So if you've lived the life of Odysseus, does that tell you anything about his character? Do you feel as if you know more about the Odysseus of the book because of the lives you've led?
He went through too many adventures, if you know. He has experienced a lot of things, as we did, as seamen, both of us.
And every man has his Odysseus inside, in his mind.
But after that, you have to settle down. And this is what all of us, we do in life. It's a lesson of life.
And when you are a young one and you go to work on a ship, you think that everything is a game. But as the years has passed, you feel very, very different.
A row of boats tethered to a jetty.
One thing I understand from meeting people like Andreas and Demetres is just how important the Odyssey is to the Greek people. Someone once said the Odyssey is alive to every tremor and gleam of existence. And that doesn't just include love and sex. Odysseus's next lesson is going to be the most powerful of all. Finally, he's about to understand the meaning of death.
The sea rushes beneath the bow of the yacht.
Tearing himself away from Circe's island, Odysseus and his remaining men once again sail for Ithaca. But he's desperate to know what the omens are. Helpfully, Circe has given him the name of a very reliable soothsayer.
Simon takes a motorboat down a river, the banks of which are lined with thick foliage.
Consulting the soothsayer seems simple enough, except there's a catch.
I'm going to hell.
He's dead.
A blood-red sun hangs on the horizon beyond the tree line.
This is the river Acheron. But round here, they have another name for it. The River of Pain. To the Greeks, it was the highway to hell. Or as Homer himself put it, a place where horrid night spreads over wretched mortals. Homer even gives directions on how to get to the underworld.
The sky is painted copper by the setting sun.
When the river finally runs out, I make the rest of the journey on foot.
He discovers a ruin.
The place itself is called Necromanteion, or Oracle of the Dead. From Homer's day right up to the 18th century, Greeks came here to contact the dark side. Getting the ghouls to appear required lots of drug taking and some really bizarre rituals. A bit like cooking.
Circe's given Odysseus a list of ingredients that he needs to pour his libations. She's told him to dig a pit and pour into it various things. Water, milk, sweet wine, honey, white barley meal, whatever that is, and the blood of a black ram. So it's a pit, a cubit each way. I think that's from your sort of wrist to your elbow, so that should do it. Okay. Here's a bit of the honey. Just drip a little bit of that in. That's that. So the local supermarket didn't really have everything that I wanted, but I've got the nearest that I could. A bit of the white barley meal. Now, this is actually rice pasta, but it's the nearest that I could get. And then the sweet wine. Obviously, the dead have a bit of a sweet tooth. So in that goes, like so. Bit of milk. Could only get semi-skimmed, so hope that's okay. The supermarket were right out of black ram's blood, so a bit more sweet wine, I think. And according to the recipe, that should do the trick. Just have to sit back and wait for the ghost to appear.
An unearthly smoke swirls around the ruins.
The libations are poured, and Homer invokes a terrifying spectacle. Out of the swirling mist come the dead, and it's not just the old, it's children crying for their mothers, it's mothers crying for their children, it's soldiers in their battle garments all tattered and bloody and torn. It's a terrifying occasion.
Ghostly faces appear in the fog.
With the preliminaries over, the soothsayer appears. He's called Tiresias, and he has some good news. Odysseus will return safely to Ithaca and be reunited with his wife. So far, so good. But the flames licking around Odysseus's feet are about to get hotter.
Simon descends into the bowels of the dark, dank building.
In one of the most compelling and affecting passages in the whole poem, the face of a dead woman appears out of the darkness, which Odysseus finally recognises as his own mother. And to begin with, he refuses to accept it, and then he asks, "What kind of foul play brought about this murder? Tell me, and I will revenge it." And his mother says, "There was no murder, Odysseus. I died out of longing for you. I died of a broken heart."
Simon explores a subterranean chamber.
News of his mother's death shakes Odysseus to his core. But it gets worse. The next spook in line is Achilles, the greatest warrior of the Trojan War. Or is he? Achilles doesn't see himself that way anymore.
And he at once made answer and said, "Never try to reconcile me to death, glorious Odysseus. I should choose, so I might live on earth, to serve as the hireling of another, some landless man with hardly enough to live on, rather than be lord over all the dead that have perished."
Achilles, apparently, would rather be a nobody on earth than a hero in hell. Coming from one of mythology's greatest ever fighters, it's a pitiful speech.
In the whole of classical mythology, only a handful of people get to visit the underworld and live to tell the story. Tiresias has offered Odysseus a glimmer of hope, but he's seen friends and family as ghosts, and he's witnessed the greatest warrior ever known to mankind reduced to wretchedness and misery. Is this how heroes are rewarded by the gods?
Sailing at dawn.
Odysseus travels onwards, but he does so a changed man. To him, everything he achieved at Troy now just seems like a huge waste.
Simon's relaxing on board another sailing vessel. This one is a red longboat with a stylized image of waves painted on the sail and the hull.
Tiresias's advice to Odysseus has been about as clear as mud. So after his harrowing night in hell, he nips back to see Circe, who describes the route he must take as a kind of supernatural obstacle course. First challenge, sail past the alluring sirens.
Water bulges over the ship's bow.
In Greek mythology, the sirens were temptresses who lured sailors to their deaths just because they could.
A beautiful woman sings and makes alluring gestures with her hands.
Circe's warned Odysseus of the sirens. They may be enchanting, she says, but around their feet you'll see rotting corpses. Once again, Odysseus can't help himself. But this time, he hatches a plan that means he can have his cake and eat it.
Two sirens stand on the shore.
Odysseus tells his men to bung their ears with wax so they won't be able to hear the beautiful song of the sirens, and then to lash him to the mast. Why he doesn't bung his own ears with wax, he doesn't really explain. But it's one of those moments that opens a little window on his personality. This isn't just about the destination, this is about the journey. He wants to experience the experience. Odysseus is a man who likes to sail pretty close to the wind.
The sirens reach out to the sea.
It's also as if the adventurers are queuing up to meet him now. Next, he's got to sail between Scylla on one side, a 12-legged, six-headed monster, and Charybdis on the other, a whirling pool of water that sucks everything down three times a day. He's having a bit of a tough time of it.
A car ferry crossing a body of water.
Odysseus isn't the only one struggling. From around 600 crew who set off from Troy, there's maybe only 50 left. And they're not happy. I want to get a sense of what it's like to be at sea for long periods. So I've come to a naval base on the Greek mainland. Today's sailors live and work among the cold, clean lines of grey steel. But 3,000 years ago, when Odysseus was a captain, the fleet would have looked very different.
From a modern navy ship to a wooden vessel with oars jutting out the side.
This is a reconstruction of an ancient Greek warship. The design dates from the 5th century BC, which is actually 500 years after Odysseus. But the conditions on Odysseus's ship wouldn't have been all that different.
It's all skeleton and no flesh. You know, there's no concession here to comfort or convenience. There's no obvious place to eat, sit down, sleep, go to the loo. And for these three rows of oarsmen, you've either got somebody's backside in your face or you've got somebody's sandal in your ear. I don't know which would be in the worst, sitting up here with the wind and the spray lashing you, or down there in the stinking bilges. Maybe this was the prime position, somewhere here in the middle. It's an invention of travel and war. It's all function. It's just for the task of getting there.
and getting back. Oh, and I suppose, you know, killing a few people in either direction.
There's no doubt, back then, it would have been a very grim existence.
Simon makes his way to a modern warship moored at the naval base.
I'd love to chat with Odysseus about his leadership skills, but since I can't, I thought I'd try the next best thing. Commander Spiros Lagaras is in charge of 160 men on the Greek Navy frigate Nikephoros Phokas. I've come to talk to him about Odysseus' increasingly bolshy crew. But before I do, I cheekily wonder whether he fancied himself as a bit of a modern-day Odysseus.
Yes. Has it ever crossed your mind that, as a man of rank in the Greek Navy, you are in some ways a descendant of Odysseus? I mean, could you have his DNA in your bloodstream?
I think that all Greeks do believe that we do have a connection with Odysseus, and you can say so, yes. This is the way I feel, and I think most of us feel this way, yeah.
What kind of qualities are needed to be a sailor?
Discipline and being able, you know, to function as a team are the main characteristics of a mariner. Of course, you have to bear in mind that crews for Odysseus' time were free men. In other navies, this was not the case. They had slaves. But in Greek ships, they always had free men. And they were not always, you know, the professionals that we do have in the Navy today. They were farmers, they were fishermen, and I think that's the reason that we do see things not being done properly and not being a very disciplined man the way we see this today.
So if they were just a selection of, you know, fishermen and farmers, it would mean that they would have to have fantastic respect for their captain, for discipline to remain. And once that respect had gone, then presumably the discipline would break down.
That's true, that's true. I mean, it's one of the worst things that can really happen. I mean, I would say then you do have a mutiny.
And a mutiny is precisely what Odysseus is about to face.
The modern naval crew stand to attention.
Miserable and starving, his crew finally crack. Spotting some tasty-looking cattle at the next island, they move in for the kill. Odysseus warns them not to touch the animals, since they belong to the god of the sun. But while he sleeps, they defy him, gorging themselves on the forbidden flesh. The gods then at once showed forth portents. The hides crawled, the meat both roast and raw bellowed upon the spits, and there was a lowing as though of cattle.
The striking blue and white striped flag of Greece flutters above Simon, sailing as the sun sets.
Odysseus and his men will pay a heavy price for their barbecue. Back at sea, the gods smash their ship to pieces, and everybody dies. Everybody, that is, except Odysseus. Clinging to a piece of driftwood, he swept towards the nearest island and the low point of his life.
Water lapping against jagged rock.
The island Odysseus washes up on is called Ogygia. It's now 7 years later, and Odysseus is still here. Clean out of ideas and paralysed into inaction, Odysseus is on the rocks. His mother's dead, his men are dead, and it's now 2 decades since he last saw home. To make matters worse, he's also the prisoner and sex slave of a goddess called Calypso.
By night indeed, he would sleep by her side perforce in the hollow caves, unwilling beside the willing nymph. But by day he would sit on the rocks and the sands, racking his heart with tears and groans and griefs. And he would look out over the unresting sea, shedding tears.
The tears are for his lost wife, Penelope, and for himself. The arrogant hero of Troy is no more. This is a broken man. But then, something happens. After 7 depressing years, the gods decide to give him one last chance.
So Hermes, the messenger of the gods, is dispatched in his golden immortal sandals with the little wings on the bottom. And he flies across the sea, very close to the surface, like a cormorant, it says.
Hermes forces Calypso to free Odysseus and give him the thing he most needs to get home. A boat.
Simon climbs back on board the boat, brings up the anchor, then sets sail. He takes the helm.
It's true that a man could have a worse jailer than a beautiful nymph with a healthy sexual appetite, but the compass of his heart points in the direction of Ithaca and Penelope, and this is his big chance. He sets sail. Potentially, he's only a couple of days from home. All he needs now is a following wind and the gods to smile kindly upon him.
The trouble is, not all the gods are smiling on him. Especially his nemesis, Poseidon, god of the sea, who has one last act of revenge up his sleeve.
So saying, he gathered the clouds, and seizing his trident in his hands, troubled the sea and roused all blasts of every sort of wind, and hid with clouds land and sea alike. And down from heaven night came rushing.
Simon steers through the waves.
Abandoning his sinking ship, Odysseus swims for his life.
Rain hammers down.
And then a miracle.
A small island.
Land.
Simon observes from the bow.
It's not yet Ithaca, but he's now tantalizingly close.
You could think of Odysseus as the first ever tourist around the Greek islands, albeit an accidental one. That's Corfu, traditionally associated with the island of Scheria, land of the Phaeacians, and that would have looked very, very sweet. By this time, he's been bobbing around in the sea for the best part of 3 weeks, first on a raft and then just clinging to a spar. It's not home, but I think by this point it would have been a case of any port in a storm.
A marching band, and young boys and girls taking part in a street procession.
Today, the locals are celebrating. It's the anniversary of their unification with Greece.
Sections of the band are in naval uniform.
Looks like I've landed in Corfu at just about the right time. All this pomp and ceremony. They're famous here for their hospitality, so I can only think that Odysseus would have been in good hands.
A Greek Orthodox priest addresses the crowd.
The king is delighted to offer free board and lodging. In return, he asks only one thing, that Odysseus agrees to tell his story.
Νην δόνομα πρώτον μυθίσομε. Είμαι Οδυσσεύς Λαερτιάδης. Ως πάση δόλησιν ανθρώπιση μέλο.
The Corfu Poetry Society is tonight re-enacting Odysseus's famous speech. The moment when he rediscovers the hero inside and tells the complete story of his travels.
From Troy the wind bore me and brought me to the Chicones, to Ismarus. There I sacked the city and slew the men.
Actor Nikos begins the story in the original ancient Greek. But then it's time for me to take over with a version of the poem I wrote myself.
I mean, I feel a bit presumptuous, I have to say.
After a 7-year crisis of confidence, Odysseus is now able to recognise his own failings and learn from them.
So this is following on from the piece that you read. We plundered the city, took meat and wine and women and grain to be shared equally among the men. And I ordered the retreat, leave the rest, back to the boats everyone, back to the coast. But my army were boggle-eyed with treats, went on slaughtering the plentiful flocks and herds. And while they butchered and ate and slept, the enemy grew, drew strength from further afield, gathered all night in the dark, then attacked out of the dawn mist. Cut us down like stalks, flattened us into the battlefields. 6 men from every crew were lost. The rest of us skedaddled in the boats. Sick with grief, we saluted our dead, then swung our oars into the water and rowed and rowed and rowed.
Simon gazes at the glittering sea.
Odysseus has done a lot of rowing since Troy, but he won't have to do much more. His hosts, moved by his dream to be reunited with his wife, agree to take him home. But is Odysseus ready for Ithaca? Is he ready for the biggest challenge of all?
The more I walk in his shadow and the more I sail in his wake, the more intriguing Odysseus becomes as a character. Yes, he can be heroic, capable of great bravery and courage, but he can also be arrogant, conceited, greedy, flirtatious, voyeuristic, indulgent, indolent even. There are a couple of moments in the text when, instead of being on his toes and ready, he's snoring his head off. He also seems like a born liar. To almost everybody he meets, he describes himself as somebody else, and it makes me think that the real mystery of this book and the real excitement isn't whether or not we're going to find out if he gets home. It's whether we're going to find out who this man is.
George steers the yacht, and Simon reads his copy of the poem as the sun sets.
Odysseus makes his last journey not as a captain, but an ordinary passenger, hitching a lift on a ship organised by his hosts. Still fearing Poseidon's wrath, they sail at night in the hope that he won't notice. And it works.
Crystal waters gently caress a shingle beach. A single whitewashed house stands alone on a headland. Serene turquoise water dotted with dark patches of hidden rocks.
A decade after he first set sail from Troy, Odysseus finally reaches the glittering paradise that is home. Ithaca.
The gentle waves lap against the shore.
If Homer really is our first author, then it's amazing that he should have such a finely developed sense of drama and irony. In the hands of a lesser writer, Odysseus would arrive home in a blaze of glory. But actually, he falls asleep on the boat as he's been brought here by the Phaeacians. He's deposited on this beach, and when he wakes out of his slumber, he doesn't recognise the place. He doesn't even know his home.
Simon wanders along the beach. Now he's on board a coach, travelling along a mountain road overlooking a bay. He's engrossed in the poem.
He may be home, but his journey won't truly be over till he reclaims his wife and his son. But to do that, he faces one last battle.
A sign for an archaeological site called School of Homer.
In his absence, Odysseus's mountain palace has been overrun by the so-called suitors. The suitors are a bunch of local gentry who've long since had their eyes on Odysseus's money and Penelope, his wife.
Many people claim that this was the actual site of Odysseus's splendid palace. It's seen better days, but these rooms here were where the suitors were camped out, feasting and gorging and lighting their fires. Up there was Penelope's apartment and bedchamber.
After years of pressure, Penelope knows she can't stall the suitors any longer, which is why she's finally agreed to remarry. Her new husband will be the suitor who wins her in a great sporting contest, a competition involving archery and 12 axe heads.
Whoever could string Odysseus's great bow and then fire an arrow through the 12 axe heads would win her hand in marriage. So that means that this area here was where that competition took place.
I've never fired an arrow before.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Katerina.
But these local archery experts say they can teach me in 15 minutes.
Welcome to the Palace of Odysseus.
Using a bow that Odysseus himself would have recognised.
It's a beautiful thing. It's much lighter than I thought it would be. Very balanced. I guess it's one of those odd pieces of equipment which is both art and it can kill you.
Odysseus, disguised as a beggar, enters the palace just in time for the start of the competition.
And then, don't release, just all right.
Yes. Yeah, OK. Right, I'm all set, I think.
OK. While Penelope waits upstairs, the suitors each take their turn, all hoping to shoot clean through the axe heads lined up across the room.
Simon fails to hit the target.
In the end, though, no one can do it.
It's a good job I'm not Cupid. There'd be some very lonely people out there.
Still hiding behind his beggar's clothes, Odysseus steps forward and asks if he can have a go. It's the moment he's been waiting for.
Lower.
Oh!
Well done.
Get in!
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Odysseus hits the mark first time. In the melee, loyal servants quietly lock the doors. Odysseus then shakes off his beggar's disguise, and the bloodbath begins. Homer doesn't spare us the details. The suitor's ringleader takes the first shot full in the neck, causing blood to spew through his nose. One by one, the others succumb in similar fashion. Homer compares their flaccid bodies to dead fish in nets and describes their souls, crying like bats as they're led into hell. When it's over, the maids who've been disloyal during Odysseus's absence are told to clean up the mess, then taken outside and hung. Odysseus has won the battle for his house, but he must now win back Penelope. The two meet after the massacre, but she still can't quite believe it's him.
He's been away for 20 years, but she seems so hard and unwelcoming. And they have what, in today's parlance, might be described as a bit of a domestic. She sends him to the spare. She tells the maid to take the marital bed out of the bedroom and set it up elsewhere.
But it's the very same bed which, once and for all, gives Odysseus the chance to prove who he is. Woman, truly this is a bitter word that you have spoken. For a great token is worked into the making of the bed, and it was I that built it, and no one else. And her knees were loosened where she sat, and her heart melted.
And it's at this point that Penelope realises that he must be who he says he is. And she breaks down in tears, she throws her arms around him, and you don't need me to spell the rest of it out.
A classical painting of Odysseus and Penelope by Francesco Primaticcio. They're both nude, and Odysseus has a tender hand held to his wife's chin.
The poem ends with Odysseus getting the girl and the glory.
In a sleepy coastal town, families eat and drink at the cafes and walk hand in hand along the promenade.
It's hard to appreciate what being away from family and friends for 20 years actually feels like. But I've made this journey to try and get a sense of the difficulties and the distances involved. And it seems to me that it's impossible to understand Odysseus. Because after all his trials and tribulations, and after all his humiliations and the hardship, he doesn't really understand himself.
All he has is that longing to return, the nostos, as the Greeks call it, and he won't be allowed that pleasure until he's been stripped of his crown and his clothes and his dignity and his identity. Not until he's arrived home with the appearance of a beggar scrounging for crumbs at his own table, will he be allowed to return as a father and a husband? So the question of whether or not I like Odysseus now seems irrelevant. He will always remain an endlessly intriguing and enigmatic character. And we have Homer to thank for that. He's the real hero of this story. Whoever Homer is, he's the one to be admired.
Perched on a bench, Simon stares out at the peaceful bay.
Coming up on BBC Four, Time Shift on the British Army of the Rhine and the lives of families sent to live in post-war Germany. Next.